the J-Talk Podcast.
Yes. It's missed by Vertonghen. It's a great chance for Haraguchi. He scores! Here's Kagawa, trying to find room for the shot. He'll eventually come in. 2-0! Takashi Inoue! What a strike! Courtois safely grabbed. And there's just time for De Bruyne to lead this attack. Japan desperate to cover the spaces. They can't do so for the moment. Lukaku, and here's the winner! Oh, can you believe it? Nasser Chadli!
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell, and no, I can't believe it. Japan are out of the World Cup after blowing a 2-0 second half lead against Belgium in the early hours of Tuesday morning, Japan time. And joining me for the post-mortem are Cesare Polenghi from Football Tribe and Scott McIntyre from the Asian Game Podcast. Cesare, they had it in their hands and they let it slip away.
Yeah, they did. I mean, it's, in a way, it was just like the epitome of a defeat. I mean, just like it doesn't get any better, right? Especially for a country that sort of cherishes tragic heroes as Japan. It was just as tragic as it could get.
And Scott, coming to us from a remote train station somewhere in Russia, I believe making your way back to Japan. Coming back with your tail between your legs. I mean, yeah, you're hoping obviously to make another stop on your stay in Russia, but unfortunately it's all over.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I fancy the 32-hour train ride back up to Kazan, but it's such a, really, it's, I mean, I don't know how many hours now we're on from the game. I was inside the stadium and, you know, those two goals that came early in the second half and the emotion really that came with that. And then to see what happened, you know, I mean, again, I mean, we'll get into it in detail, but to really, I think, again, this blind loyalty to AJ Quashman, there's some kind of diesel train going by in the background here, has really undone Japan in many ways. And to see them then concede another couple of goals after that, it's frankly hard to believe because, you know, Ben, I'm one for hyperbole, but at that point, I really thought, and still now, I think this is going to be one of the moments that in our lifetime we could have said an Asian nation was actually a chance of winning the World Cup. I think Belgium to this point had been one of the better, if not the best, teams at the tournament to date. They're ranked third in the world. This, you know, the slew of big name players, and Japan went toe to toe with them for a long period of time. And I honestly believe if they had of not conceded that really ridiculous goal to concede, that they were controlling the match, they could have scored another, and if they win that, I really firmly believe that they could have gone on and won the World Cup. And this, it's I don't know if we're ever going to be in a position in our lifetimes to see a nation with such a good chance, you know, with already the big nations that hadn't qualified, the big nations that have fallen, and to dominate the Belgium the way they did for periods in this game. I really felt that they could have gone on. There's clearly some supporters out here as well. They could have gone on and really breaking its football.
All right, you dropped out there for the last couple of seconds of your comment, Scott. But yes, so frustrating for everyone who loves the Japanese game. Scott's right, Cesare. I mean, Japan were the better team for large stretches of this game, not only when they went 2-0 up, but I felt in the first half as well, they had periods of, I don't think dominance is the right word, but they had a lot of possession in the first half, more than I thought they would. And while they did have to weather a strong 10 minutes from Belgium around the 20-minute mark, once they regained a foothold in the game, they finished the first half strongly, I felt.
Well, you know, I think that what was really disappointing is, like, you know, across the games in the group, and I would say all the way until Belgium scored the first goal, maybe, you know, for the first time ever, you really had the sensation that the Japanese team was in control of the game. Management was perfect. And With Colombia, they had a fantastic second half. With Senegal, twice they came back, rather smoothly. And, with Poland, you might clearly criticize those last 10, 15 minutes, but even that was sort of proof of maturity in a way. I mean, like, in the end, they achieved the results. And in a way, one thing I'm wondering is, if it wasn't maybe that the second goal maybe was a little too much. That's the point where, Japan became a little too self-confident, and then that really unfortunate, when we paid the Kawashima's tax for the third time in the tournament, it was sort of like a very abrupt return to reality, and then we went back to sort of like, the sort of like nightmarish performances that we've seen several times. Basically, a lack of focus, lack of confidence, and overall, a sort of like immaturity in the way the game was managed. So I think that the disappointment also came from the fact that, there was really this feeling through the first three games and all the way until the second goal. Japan has really learned to play football. I don't know how to translate this in English, but in Italian, I will comment this, something like, the Japanese can play ball, but they cannot play soccer. Meaning, they're good with the ball, they're good at kicking the ball around, at scoring goals, it's just moving around, but they're not very good at, seeing football as a, with a 360 degrees, perspective. And if I felt for a few games that has changed, but then it hadn't when it really mattered, so. And it was really disappointing to see this last, 40, when it was 35, 40 minutes, it was a nightmare.
Indeed. All right, well, we'll come on to the euphoria of the first 10 minutes of the second half in just a moment, Scott. But obviously, Belgium had the big names on paper, Romelu Lukaku and Eden Hazard leading their attack. But for me, one of the most impressive things about the Japanese performance was the performances of Yuya Osako and especially Shinji Kagawa on the not only in the second half when Japan were in control, but throughout the entire game. For me, it was Kagawa's best performance since the 2013 Confederations Cup, and he certainly answered a lot of critics on this night, I feel, because there were some questioning whether he would come straight back into the team after being rested against Poland, but he certainly justified Akira Nishino's faith in him with a very strong performance.
Yeah, I agree with all that, and then I would also step back 10 or 15 meters and say that I thought Gaku Shibasaki was absolutely outstanding again, and I think he's been not a revelation because he's not a new player, but he's been a revelation in the way that he's played, and I think in many ways he's been the glue that has allowed it all really to tick over. I mean, he's done a fantastic job alongside Hasebe in screening things from a defensive role, which allows Hasebe to sit as the six, and then he's operating as the eight, so he has the chance to push forward and create these attacks and then bring the likes of Kagawa and Osako into the game as well. And it's a situation now with Kagawa where I think he's clearly grown in confidence, and you can see he's the for the players that were selected in the 23. He's clearly, he's the man at number 10, right? I mean, Honda has come on and played in a wider role, drifted centrally on occasions, and from what he said after the game, we understand that he's probably finished now with the international game. But this really was the chance for Kagawa to sit there in the hole and create things, and you could see he wanted to be on the ball, and when he was on the ball, he was making things happen. He was bringing others into play. He was working nice little one-twos with either Osako or either of the wingers, and then confident enough to get on the ball and try and create things himself. So not just in this game, but I think again throughout the tournament, there's been a maturity, and that's a word that we've used a lot, I think, with a lot of the players in different positions and the team as a whole, and we've seen that in Kagawa's game. And again, as we talked about last time, I think we need to put a lot of this down to Nishino and the spirit that he's created in the camp. I said to you pre-tournament that the things that people don't see are often the most important things. You know, the the players that, you know, they're sharing rooms with, who they're sitting next to at the breakfast table, what seat they have on the bus next to which player. And these kind of things, when you're away from home for 4, 5, 6 weeks, make a massive difference. The players clearly didn't enjoy those experiences during the time without Halo Hostage, and they clearly do now. We don't know if Nisha's going to continue or not. And you can see that togetherness, that spirit, coming through, as I said to you last time, in the Poland game when they came off at halftime, you probably couldn't see it on the television, but the fact that the substitutes waited to do their warm-ups and they greeted all the players as they came off the pitch, you know, it really showed that I haven't seen this belief and this camaraderie in the squad for a long, long time. And I think you can see that transferring over into the performances of the players you mentioned of Shibasaki. I mean, the fullbacks were brilliant. I thought this was probably the best I've seen Maya Yoshida play in a long time as well. We saw some kind of a progression in Gen Shoji's game that I didn't think I would see either. Haraguchi was excellent. Inui was probably Japan's best player at the tournament. Really, you can go through the entire squad with the exception of the goalkeeper and say they almost didn't have a bad player. They got impact off the bench when it was needed at crucial moments as well. And again, the credit needs to go to the JFA. I mean, Tashima was there post-match kind of lapping in the glory, if that's possible, after this kind of defeat. He called it, you know, one of Japan's best ever performances, which I concur with, certainly at a World Cup. And you could almost see, you know, a little bit of the chest being puffed out that he'd made this brave, in many ways, un-Japanese call to make such a big decision on the eve of the tournament. And it was justified. And the work that Nishino and the staff has done, I had a chance to beat a few training sessions, and as well, you could see it was focused, but there was also a joy in the team being there at this stage and being together, and it's a justification for all these things. And now we need to consider what happens with Nishino. Do they move on after that? I saw some crazy reports today. Apparently, Jurgen Klinsmann, for some reason, has been linked with the job. So if that's the option, then I think they're better off sticking with Nishino. But these are all questions for the future. But, as you said, some fantastic performances individually, but also collectively. And, such a shame.
I would basically agree with everything you guys said. I was really impressed by, you know, of course, by Shibasaki, by, you know, with Kagawa. I just like, you know, just for the sake of argument, just not to repeat exactly the same thing, I just wondering what would have happened if Japan wouldn't have got that penalty in the third minute of the first game, or if Kagawa had missed that. I think the funny thing about football is just like it's a, you know, a low score game, you know, like a game that ends 1-0, 2-0, 2-1, something like that. So one single episode might determine, you know, everything that happened in a game and eventually in a tournament. I think that, you know, Kagawa is a very humoral person. Is that English? Humoral? Yeah, I mean, he's a very, he's sort of a moody, you know, player. You know, sometimes, you know, like he has periods of brilliance, and then, you know, like he had a couple of so-so games, and he starts to get gloomy and depressed, and, you know, and he basically sucks for a month or two. I think that, you know, the decision of taking the penalty, which actually wasn't kicked that well, and then maybe that was really what clicked for him, and the fact that, you know, it clicked for him, it then made it click for the whole team, because, you know, he's really, really important. I think that since, from 2010 up to now, up to this tournament, we've seen a very good Japan only when both Honda and Kagawa did well, or at least one of them, you know, like somehow, you know, led the team in the middle of the pitch. And yeah, this time was mainly only Shinji, but I think, you know, like it's sort of like he had a lot of people dubbed at him, including me, you know, to just have, you know, to be forced to admit that, you know, he still has the capacity, the skill to be, you know, like a top player. And I just had one note on the side for Nagatomo. Nagatomo is just like, you know, why do you want to speak about him? Because he played in Italy for 7 years. And for some reasons, you know, he's been made fun of for 7 years in Italy. It's just like, you know, he's just like this smurf, you know, like who played for Inter and just like in certain instances was even the captain. And he was used as a symbol of Inter a new mediocrity. This is incredibly stupid, you know, like, and it just shows how superficial Italian fans can be at times. Well, first of all, you know, he's been a starter, you know, in Serie A for most of the 7 years, even though Inter has changed, I don't know, maybe probably a dozen of managers, at least 6 or 7. And, you know, the end result of this is that now he's been one of the best side backs at the World Cup in a historical period where really there are very few of them, was sold to Galatasaray for 2.5 million euro, which is a ridiculous amount for a player. He just shows such amazing performances. I also like the fact, you know, like he was after the game, after this game, very positive, and he's just, you know, he's very open. He said, we did all we could. He wasn't, you know, smiling or giggling, but he surely wasn't crying about himself. He seems like, you know, he was just the embodiment of, you know, those who could somehow manage to live this experience are, okay, hell of a ride. And, you know, we move on from now. I think he was really, really good. There's a lot that we can go on and talk about individuals. But, okay, just one thing. So maybe to move on to the next point. Of course, I think we need to address Kawashima. You know, it's not only the fact that he made those big mistakes. We sort of expected him to do, you know, maybe not as many, but it was a liability to a certain extent. But I think that the thing that has to be discussed here is not just him, but the fact that since 2010, Japan hasn't been able to produce a better goalkeeper than Kawashima. That, to see, I see, like, the lack of you know, production of goalkeepers, center backs, and eventually, you know, like a center forward. Osako is very good, but it's more or less one of a kind. It's been, you know, like what has more or less always had Japan to feel a little incomplete. And I don't know if just like the JFA is going to, you know, somehow trying to address this, because this is clearly like a huge technical handicap. We really, you know, don't have enough good, you know, there's a lot in Japan, there's a lot of good side backs, a lot of good midfielders, you know, side attackers, you know, like plenty of them. Actually, even too many. We had to leave some very good ones at home. But then again, the, you know, the quality of the goalies and the center backs and the center forwards, you know, we're lucky when we have one good one. So we had one good center back and one good center forward. That's all we had. Shoji did good, of course. But, you know, he's clearly a guy who only have very limited experience, having played on in J League. And, you know, it's, you know, I think, you know, if you think of, for example, Ed Japan won and had to continue through the tournament, you know, we've seen what happened when Nishino tried to change the, you know, six players. You know, the game against Poland was more or less, you know, like a clusterfuck of mistakes, you know, and just, it was embarrassing, you know, at all. So, yeah, I think, you know, I don't know what you guys think, but, you know, I'm wondering if the JFA is going to somehow try to address the lack of, you know, of players in certain positions, which has been, you know, historically, you know, there since, I don't know, since I followed Japan. I mean, you can really count on the fingers or your hand, you know, good center backs, you know, like, and I think Miyamoto and Yoshida are the only two who played abroad, for example, so that really gives you the idea.
Okay, that's, very well said, Cesare. So, Scott, how are you going to reconcile this at the end of the day? Because you were pro-Nishino from the start. You said it was the right thing to do, and it's proved that it was, because Japan got out of the group. You praised him for his six changes against Poland because the conditions were just unplayable for these players to get through three games in the group stage and to have any prospect of performing in the round of 16. So he's got that. He's done that. He's brought back his players who he rested, and they've all done the job pretty much on the day against Belgium. The result hasn't gone his way, of course. But is it just, has he just got this blind spot again with Kawashima? Is it something that he just wasn't able to see, or do you actually understand the fact that he never changed Kawashima, or will that just always be something that will nag you at the back of your mind because you were calling for, you've been calling for Kosuke Nakamura for 2 years?
Yeah, well, firstly, I take a polite disagreement with Cesare's assertion that they don't have a better option than Kawashima, because they certainly do, and he was sitting on the bench a couple of seats down from Nishino, and indeed should have been playing the first match. Will almost certainly be Japan's number one now for the next, in my opinion, 10 to 15 years, and has the potential, I think, to be one of the best goalkeepers that we've ever seen in Asia. This is how good he is. I think with a correct career move and guidance and perhaps maybe
yeah,
some kind of a
Scott, let me interject, but we might have seen the same thing of Nishikawa a few years ago. That's all, no, no, I'm not saying that he's not a good keeper. I'm not saying that, you know, we have zero keepers. But overall, the production of goalkeepers in since 2010 to now resulted more or less in this very promising young player who, I agree with you, is probably going to be, you know, like one of the best we've ever seen. But it's not much for a professional league out of 8 years.
But some of the issues are the same that you touched on with the forwards, because we've seen increasingly now in the J League the clubs have been employing foreign goalkeepers. I think there's now three or four Korean goalkeepers, Kaminsky at the Jubilo as well. So it's the same issue that historically the league, not just in Japan but in other parts of Asia, has had with foreign players, even under the quota system, coming in and taking those number nine roles. Now increasingly in the J League with the move to the plus one, they're taking the number ones. But even I mean at the club that Ben and I follow, you know, we have some very promising young goalkeepers, particularly Hirosue, who was very good. I saw in the high school championships 2 years ago. He's been involved in the national setup for quite a while. Hatano as well at the club. So I think also there's a reluctance to play these players at a young age, which is why Korsuke. He's an exception away. That the spell when he went on loan to Fukuoka, and I think I've watched every single professional game he's played, and so I mean it was evident right from, you know, the start when he went to Fukuoka that he was a special talent, so much that they moved an established keeper at Racehold to make a spot for him, and you know you've seen at the chances he's had at youth level, but particularly at J level, that he's a special talent, and so the decision. Not to start him in the first game, I thought, was the wrong one. And then the decision to persist with Kawashima, that was a very interesting turn of phrase. You used the term tax, which I agree. I mean, there just came a point, and I think Nishino's got almost every single thing right in the tournament, except with his stubbornness to stand by Kawashima game after game after game. And in the end, we can say it's a large factor of why Japan are going home and why they shouldn't. And I wonder if it was a different situation in a different coach, perhaps, and not a Japanese coach. You know, if they would have trusted youth, perhaps at a crucial position. Whereas Nishino hasn't done this, and yeah, I mean, what else can you say? It's blindingly obvious to everyone who's seen the blunders, you know, game after game after game. That even if you quibble and you say you want experience, whatever, then you could have put Higashiguchi in, who is probably an equal. Although not without an error in his own game, but you know the equal to what Kawashima is. So just the decision to stick with one really clearly underperforming player was surprising, and in the end, probably hurt Japan more than we like to admit.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that Kawashima will not be the goalkeeper for Japan at the next World Cup. But with the Asian Cup coming early next year, I tell you what, Scott, if Nishino stays on, as is, there's probably a 50-50 chance of that at the moment. If he stays on and Kawashima is Japan's keeper in their group stage opener at the Asian Cup, I tell you what, I reckon Scott will just about blow a gasket. But I want to come straight back to you, Scott, because you were there in Rostov-on-Don, and for 7 second-half minutes, Japan hit heights that we wondered they were capable of, and they obviously felt they were, but to do what they did on the world stage was simply stunning, and the first goal came just 3 minutes into the second half. You mentioned Shibasaki, Scott, you made a point of mentioning him earlier when I came to you about Osako and Kagawa, and so Shibasaki was the architect of Japan's opener after Takashi Inui won the ball back deep in the Japan half. He released Genki Haraguchi, who got the better of Jan Vertonghen and lashed across Thibaut Courtois. So what was it like at the stadium? I cannot imagine. But you must have, you must have blown a gasket at that point.
It was a strange situation because I don't know if you could hear it on the TV, but for much of the crowd would have been, I think, perhaps 80% Russian. So for a long period in the match, you're hearing this kind of a ubiquitous Rasi kind of chant that's been taking over the World Cup with you know some small band of support for Japan and Belgium at various points. But I just want to tell you a quick story as well. You know when you go to these tournaments and you get assigned a random desk in the media seat, and you don't know who you're sitting next to. So I was sat next to a German guy who I'm not going to name the public publications or anything like this. But he works for a major German publication. And to my kind of great amusement, for pretty much the entire match, I don't know what on earth he was doing, but he wasn't watching the game. He was typing away furiously at some kind of story, and he would stop. You know, for 10 seconds every 3 or 4 minutes, glance at a bit of play, and then go back and just keep. It was like he was writing, rewriting, on the road, the Kerouac, that classic that he did in one kind of sitting. I really don't know what he was doing. And then at halftime, he gave me all these opinions on the game, which were like totally, clearly incorrect. And he missed both goals, and then again at the end of the game, he was saying how it was a bit unfortunate for Japan, are unlucky because they weren't physical enough, but, you know, Belgium, just all this complete nonsense. And these are the point about this is, Ben, that these are the opinion setters in Europe, right? So even you have guys from these major newspapers that are being sent abroad to cover these games, and they're not watching the games properly, and then they're reinforcing all the stereotypes about Japan, which was such a disappointing thing, because as you said, both goals were beautiful goals. We can talk about the third goal from the long counter being a very clinical and well executed finish as well, but wonderful goals. And in the midst of periods of dominance, the first 20 minutes of the first half, and then that first 20 or 25 minutes until the first of the Kawashima blunders. And really what we want the world to sit up and notice is this kind of performance, not just the goals, but the way that Japan. I spoke to a few of the players after the game, and they said the same thing, that this has shown the world that Japan has technicians, and Keisuke Honda made the point of saying as well that European clubs need to sit up and take notice of Japanese football. Of course, there's already a lot of players in Europe, but he said they need to come to the J League, they need to look more regularly at these kind of players, and they need to take them to Europe because we need this experience. And when you've got idiots like this major German correspondent sitting next to me, not watching the game, and then. Relaying, although I understand it's 2018, people are watching on TV, but reinforcing these kind of stereotypes, it just, it doesn't do justice to what, to the performance that Japan put in. Really, an amazing performance to not cower, to come here and say, we're going to go toe-to-toe with Belgium, we're not going to sit back, we're not going to, put 10 players behind the ball and try and strike on a counter, or take a moment from a set piece or scrap their way to penalties. They came against one of the world's best nations and stood next to them and said, we're going to play. And I think it's a fantastic thing. And really all followers of Japanese football should be very, very proud of this team and what they've done.
Yeah. Can I just to add up to what you said, one thing that really surprised me is that, a lot of people just like were asking me about Inui and just like, who's this guy? Where is he coming from? I mean, he's been in La Liga for like 3 seasons, right? Not in the Belgium second division. He's been in La Liga, and he's been doing in La Liga more or less the same thing that he's done in these games. We know he's not particularly consistent. He's at 30 still have room for improvement. This guy is going to Betis. That Betis is the if you take away Barcelona and Real, and I think Atletico, is the team with the most supporters in the whole of Spain. It's a club with a huge history and, like a massive fandom all across the country. And they just like bought him at 30. But, most of the people were saying, oh, wow, this guy, interesting, it's not bad, he's got a good shot, you wonder, really, like this, he played in one of the, possibly the second most popular league in the world. And it's right. I mean, it goes back to what I said about Nagatomo before. There is a bias towards, Asians. Somehow, or there's a stereotype of the African player who is just like, maybe not tactically savvy, but, like runs hard, kicks hard, and so on and so forth. And, for some reasons, the cliche about the Asian players, especially East Asia, is that, they have, it's also the cartoons are not helping. Because, that's another thing that, in Italy in these days, I was on this radio show, which is the major radio show in Italy. It's called Tutti Convocati. And, it has, I think, something like 3 million people listening to it. And the episode where they invited me and Zaccheroni to talk about Japan started with Captain Tsubasa song. And that's the image that they still have about Japanese football. I think it doesn't really help, so. Oh, well, yeah, I can only agree with you. I mean, it's just, it is really, really annoying. And in a way, it makes the fact that Japan and, you know, Iran couldn't continue, you know, for a few more games, you know, it's even more annoying when you think of this. You know, there's a bit of a sense of injustice, you know, like that goes from the stands and especially those, you know, press boxes filled by people who shouldn't be there in the first place and down to the pitch, yeah.
All right. Ben, just before this conductress is about to give me the hurry up to get onto the train. Can we just get in quickly before I have to leave you onto the Nishino thing and the future thereof, whether we think he's the right guy or not?
Please do. Yeah, go ahead. Feel free to say your piece on that, Scott. No worries at all.
It's a problem with the whole cycle of the Asian Cup, which really I think needs to be moved back to you know the middle window of the World Cup. You know that 4 year window because we now have this 6 month period where it's a case to start again with a foreign coach. I think now we're all in agreement after what Nishino has done that as much as, you know, Ben, I would like to see Mr. Kazama in the role, but I think, or indeed Kosuke Nakamura, maybe as some kind of unusual goalkeeping slash coach. This might be the future. But I think we can all agree that Nishino is probably the only option now if they do a seat with a domestic candidate. So the decision is, do you start the next cycle building towards you know, Qatar with a foreigner coming in, or do you stick with Nishino through to the Asian Cup, see how he does there, and then perhaps, you know, even look to be the man to guide you through? He's done, really, again, I think a lot of this is down to Nishino, and as a matter of fact, almost all of it, in a way, is down to Nishino. We heard Inui speak after the match, and he was full of praise for Nishino, basically saying that he felt if Halu Hostic was in charge, not only would he have not been starting, but he wouldn't have even been in the squad. So, you know, obviously the players are going to play, going to say these kind of things, but it was just such an amazing, you know, period here at the World Cup where it all came together, and it all came together under Nishino. I mean, even post-match, you saw, you know, he was the one taking the fall for the play. He didn't criticise the goalkeeper, never criticised individuals, but said, you know, the last 20 minutes were all on me. You know, tactically, I got things wrong, so I need to look at, you know, what I'm doing. So, you know, he's shielding and protecting the team as well. And I think, honestly, now that Bielsa's gone to Leeds, although that might only last for 6 weeks, so he might be free again shortly. But there's no... although, again, I was talking with a few of the guys at the bar after the game last night. I think Carlos Queiroz has made a point of, you know, saying that he might leave Iran and is looking for another challenge, you know, potentially in Asia. I think he would be a fantastic option for Japan to look into as well. But I don't know the answer. I don't know if it's the right thing to start again or say, do you take Nishino, but then risk maybe undoing what happened here, you know, like when you... maybe when you go on the holiday, when you just finished school and you have a kind of summer romance, and then you know, you sit around listening to opera for the next 20 years trying to recall these experiences, and they never come back. So I need to get your take on it.
In my opinion, you know, the ideal manager for the Japanese national team would be a Japanese manager who has experience of coaching in abroad, but that person doesn't exist yet. So, you know, if you will, like, let's say if somebody like Nishino would have the chance to go and work in Europe for 2, 3, 4 years, and, you know, and then have his total understanding of the Japanese players, not only on the pitch, but also their you know, their psychology, basically, that would be the ideal person. Alternatively, I think that the opposite could be true as well. I mean, basically what we had with Ozim. So I think that a foreign coach who has some international experience, who has worked in Japan for several years, I'm thinking, of course, of people like, you know, Petrovic or Ficcadenti, that could be another option. So I don't know. It's really hard to say, but I have to agree, you know, like, I think this World Cup showed a lot, not only for Japan, but in general, that, you know, you really need one person who can understand the players and create a group, because overall these players were there, I mean, let's face it, with some exceptions such as our goalkeeper, but they're all, you know, they're top players, they're at the World Cup, they're the best players in their country. You just need, you know, they know how to play football. You just need to put them in the, you know, in a situation where, you know, they can do it at their best. And I think that, you know, probably as much as Argentina was the negative example for this tournament, Japan was the positive example. You know, it's like, you know, you had, what did Japan, well, with the exception of the goalkeeper, sorry, I gotta keep going there, but, you know, to be precise, and every player was at his, you know, I won't say 120%, but other 90 to 100%. All of them did their absolute best. including, you know, like those like Honda who came in just later and should have been very frustrated for his own personal reason. So I think that, you know, you got to give it to Nishino that he did a great job there. And since the next tournament is an Asian tournament for which Nishino clearly has experience, having won an Asian Champions League with the Gamba Osaka, he's probably, you know, at least the ideal man to continue there. What we know for sure, that what's not going to work is a foreign manager who doesn't have the patience and the dedication to understand Japan and Japanese society. I think that Halilhodžić, you know, God knows what would happen with him as a manager. It could have even gone better than with Nishino. You know, I mean, you really don't know because football is such a, you know, an unpredictable thing. But you know, clearly, if it got to where it got, something really at a personal level, at a human level, you know, didn't work. And that, of course, you know, I can't. Zaccheroni with all his poor results. But somehow, I think, you know, he was somebody that all the players speak very, you know, highly. The federation liked him. He did his part, I think, you know, in the growth of this team. A lot of the players who were at this World Cup were, you know, grown under Zaccheroni to begin with. And he absolutely did his utmost effort to understand Japan and to, you know, find a balance between, you know, his football ideology and the reality of Japan. So I'm not saying bring back Zaccheroni, I mean, God forbid. But, you know, if we bring in a manager from abroad, it should be somebody who understands the unicity of Japan and all these positives and negative sides, and in the end, how they reflect into our football culture here in Japan.
All right, I'll say my piece as well. But how are we going, Scott? Are you just about to board this train and head off?
I'm back on. The girl has just closed the retractable stairs, but the door's still open. So you've still got a brief window.
So I've got until the door closes. All right. Well, yeah. For me, the main thing that the JFA is going to have to consider is something that I saw in a tweet from our mutual friend Dan Ulowitz post game, and it's the phrase "lightning in a bottle." Did the JFA just catch lightning in a bottle with Nishino? Nishino coming in with 2 months to rescue this what appeared to be a sinking ship, and the results that they've gotten. Are they just a matter of a backs against the wall mentality that this squad were forced into with such a late managerial change? Will Nishino actually be the right man for not only 6 months or 8 months until the Asian Cup, but will he be the right man? Will he be capable of leading Japan through the next 4 years? And for me, that's the biggest thing that Tachima and the rest of the JFA hierarchy have to weigh up. And for me, if it's going to be a foreign coach, there are two names, and they've both managed Nagoya in the past, that I would look to. And one is Arsene Wenger, and the other one is Dragan Stojkovic. If they can get either of those two, I must admit to not knowing a massive amount of what Stojkovic is doing in China with Guangzhou R&F, but from what I've read, he's done a reasonable job of rescuing them from relegation a couple of years ago and getting them into a decent position in the table the last couple of seasons. So for me, both of those guys check the boxes that Cesare's mentioned about having a knowledge and a passion about the game in Japan, because both have lived it in the past. Wenger, I guess you could question his age in a similar way you could Nishino, but if he's up for the job, then for me he's the right man, because he is an absolute genius. In my opinion, and has proven himself over such a long time at Arsenal. If he'd want to do the job, for me, he would be my first choice. But yeah, that's something that the JFA is going to have to weigh up: a domestic candidate versus a foreign one. But I think, yeah, Cesare's right. It's going to have to be somebody who has a deep knowledge of the Japanese game and what this national team means to the people of Japan.
Right, Ben, this locomotive is in gear. It's underway, and I'm going to lose you. So it was great chatting. Sorry that we couldn't continue with all the way through to the 15th of July, but thanks for having me on again.
Absolutely brilliant, Scott. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your trip. This podcast will be edited and posted before you reach your final destination. So maybe if you get a decent Wi-Fi, you'll be able to download while you're still on the train. Thank you very much, mate.
Look forward to it, and ciao, Cesare.
Hey, ciao. And by the way, I don't think you have a final destination, do you?
No, I'm heading to Moscow, but I don't know after that what I'm
right, and after that, and after that. Safe travels, mate.
See you guys. Bye-bye.
All right, Cesare. Well, that was it from Scott, and yeah, absolutely terrific to catch up with him. Yes, literally from a moving train. We've had quite a time of it on the J-Talk during this World Cup. We had Sean Carroll walking home alongside a highway after the Senegal game, and now we've had Scott in a train station in Russia. Absolutely phenomenal. So, I kind of tried to get Scott to fill us in on what the atmosphere was like in the stadium when Haraguchi put Japan ahead. What was it like where you were? I presume you're in the football tribe offices in Hokkaido.
Actually, you know, like, to be completely honest, you know, I have watched all the games at our office in Tokyo, and I had to take care of some, you know, like football tribe related business meetings here in Sapporo, and I came because I sort of, you know, expected Japan to be eliminated. You know, I was at home alone, but there's still something interesting to tell you is that, of course, waking up at 3 a.m., you know, like when we watch the Premier League or Serie A or the Champions League, is sort of like sort of this kind of strange spaced out feeling that you have when you just like, you know, get out of bed and the game start straight away. So it was very dreamy for me. And here in Hokkaido, the sun comes up very early. And so, you know, like as the sun came up, I, you know, sadly woke up. And in the end, you know, like, well, you know, the dream was over by the 94th minute. But what was interesting is like how many messages I got from my friends, football friends from all over the world, you know, other fans, colleagues telling me, wow, Japan, this is amazing. I can't believe it. Oh my God, history is changing. You know, like, I probably got, I mean, not many, it's about 30, you know, 30 people, you know, sending, you know, thinking, wow, you know, like Japan is doing something really unique. And, the sad thing is that after the game, one by one, I had to, you know, reply to all the messages and say, oh, thanks for your support. And unfortunately, you know, like, it didn't last till the end. But, I think that it wasn't just, you know, in the stadium or around Japan. The positive thing about this game is that Japan really won back the fans that they won back in the first couple of games. Because as I'm sure you know, like, the game against Poland wasn't seen under a very, you know, positive light. It was last, you know, like 15, 20 minutes with the ball moved around. A lot of people really looked down on Japan for you know, like the lack of bravery in those final minutes, which actually cost Japan, the fact that they had to go and meet Belgium and eventually would have Brazil in the next game eventually. Yeah. But, you know, I think that the performance against Belgium, despite, you know, the final loss, it just sort of like, you know, the last World Cup, the one in 2014, was very humiliating. It was really humiliating. The way Japan, you know, like dropped that lead against Ivory Coast, the fact that it couldn't win against the 10-man Greece, and the way they got trashed and, you know, made fun of against Colombia, it was really, really bad. It was like a huge step backwards from 2010. And that goes together also with the very, you know, let's call it unlucky Asia Cup. Two really miserable East Asia Cups. So I think that, you know, this World Cup did a lot for Japan football and for its image in Japan and in the world. Though, and this is a point I wanted to make and I would love to discuss with Scott, I don't think it was the best World Cup ever for Japan. I think the 2010 team was more well-rounded and overall, I think the team, you know, was better than the one we had now, in my opinion. But this team, you know, as we said, did so well considering their potential. And, you know, if you remember what I told in last time you had me after the Colombia game, you know, like, about 80% of the fans thought that, you know, out of 15,000 fans who replied to a survey I made on Twitter, thought that Japan in the group would have made either 0 or 1 point. Mm. So they made 3 in the first game, you know, already in a bingo already there. So, you know, it's just overall, you know, at the end of a World Cup, you put together the good and the bad, you know, every team more or less, you know, they're, you know, we're not the winners or losers. Only one, you know, like goes home with the trophy. I think, you know, I'll put Japan among the winners, you know, like, there's no doubts about that. Some of the players really stood out. Japan, you know, forget about the results, but play at the same level, okay, I would say, throughout 4 games with, you know, Belgium, Poland, Senegal, and 10-man Colombia, okay? But, yeah, of course, Colombia were 10-man because one of the players, you know, stopped a shot on goal with the head. So, fair enough. So, you know, 4, like, top national team possibly Senegal the best in Africa now. Belgium, you know, number three in the world. I mean, so many outstanding players, you know, like, you know, Belgium has some players who can play in every club in the world. I mean, like a guy like, you know, even Courtois, Hazard, you know, De Bruyne, each one of those guys. Fellaini is a very underestimated player just because he's ugly, you know. Like, in Italy, he would be one of everybody's favorite player because it's just like a, you know, an ugly and effective player. I mean, Belgium is such a good thing. And still Japan, you know, like, you know, if you look at 90 minutes, played at the same level. The game could have gone, you know, both ways. So this is a real, real achievement, you know. And I hope that despite, you know, the stupid commentaries by most, you know, Western observers, those who are actually in the business of, you know, of football, so who are actually, you know, their money, their career depends on how they, you know, observe football, will take notice and will give chances to more players to go to Europe and to improve. You know, I think that, you know, if you take a player like Hasebe or Yoshida or Nagatomo, they're not amazing players. They're not top players. But through, you know, like almost, you know, like a decade, well, you know, all these years I've been in Europe, they have become very good players, like very, very good players. You know, the fact of like constantly playing at a certain level, you know, training with certain teammates, being under the pressure of the European fans and media, you know, made them better. And that was the backbone of upon which this performance was built. But honestly, how many Japanese players do we have abroad now? Is it like 30, something like that? I mean, if we compare it, say, to, you know, like Argentina or Brazil or even the African countries that have hundreds of thousands, you know, players abroad, it's still probably not enough. We don't have enough players in Europe to put on a competitive squad. Maybe we can have like, you know, 8, 11th of a team, something like that. But in order to do very, very well at this level, I think we need like 15, possibly 20. So I think that, you know, the thing that is necessary, even though the J-League will suffer this, is that really, you know, we find a way to send more players to Europe. Japanese players are, you know, are serious professionals. They're hard workers. They never create problems. They're cheap. And so, you know, I think they usually they become a very good asset for those teams who decide to bet on them. And, you know, I really hope that more will, you know, go to Europe, and little by little, you know, there will be more players to, you know, a bigger pool of players to choose from, and overall the performance will, you know, keep improving and keep, you know, like being less, you know, like playing good ball, but
yeah, I mean,
I mean being more like about football, you know, to going back to my initial, you know, to my opening discussion.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of cautionary tales, though, of course, aren't there, of young players taking the plunge and making a move to Europe and then coming back with their tails between their legs. So it really is, important that if a player does decide to make the move, that he's got 100% confidence that he's going to stick it out. And, you know, I mean, there are plenty of incidents where players don't get in the team early doors, and then they might get let their head drop, and then 3 or 4 months later they're shuttled back to Japan.
Well, for me, I'm going to be very cynical about this. It's just like, you know, in the Russo-Japanese War, when the Japanese have to take a hill, they will throw, you know, like 1,000 soldiers to get the hill. Half of them will die, but they will get the hill. So if in order to have, you know, the Yoshidas and Inui and Shibazaki, if we need to have some Sekine and some, you know, Yamaguchi coming back with the tail between the leg after, you know, 1 year or 2 years, well, I mean, like, so be it. I don't think that's the issue. I mean, if the players, you know, like, want, you know, feel that they want to go, their agent feel they want to go, their family feel they want to go, they should go. Of course, you know, one thing that probably, you know, what the J-League should do, they should try to sell them a little better. So, I mean, you know, to make some money out of it and to sell them to the right club, you know, there clearly have been some unfortunate, you know, like transfers in recent months as well, in recent years. Okay, sometimes things can be do better, you know, like the clubs can monetize more, and you know, the players and the agents can choose the club better. But I don't know. I'm thinking, you know, like, let me give you an example. Okay, think of those guys who in Belgium and in Portugal who weren't picked for this World Cup. And of course, I'm talking about you, Yakubo and Doan and Nakajima. Okay, and think at the end, like, of a guy who never wanted to go to Europe, which is Yuko Bayashi. okay, who had chances to go and refused to go. Well, who is better off at this point in their career, after all? None of them made it to the World Cup, but clearly, you know, if you look at them as a professional, I think that the guys who went to Europe really have an edge over those who didn't. So I think that as much as possible, you know, we need to send them off. And okay, one thing, sorry, I have to go back to the center back goalkeeper thing. One thing which is very important is that, you know, the football people in Japan need to grab those tall guys and teach them to play football when they're in their teenager years. Because I've been working in a very famous high school for sports. Okay. And, you know, we had a great soccer team who made it twice in 3 years to the national tournament, but we didn't have any tall guy. And, you know, the philosophy of the school was, no, tall guy, sorry, they need to go to basketball and to volleyball. Right. So if the few tall guys who are there are taken by those, allow me to say, minor sports.
Yeah.
Right? That's what I honestly, you know, I'm a football racist, okay? So I just like, you know, I consider, you know, I'm a footballist. So, you know, we are going to have those guys who are just like always, you know, 3, 5, 10 centimeters smaller than their opponent in any given international game. And that's a huge handicap. You know, if Japan would have had another 2 Maya Yoshida, maybe Fellaini wouldn't have scored that goal. Mm. So it's just like, you know, we need to, you know, you need to bring in some big, this is just like not, you know, like a big guy supremacy concept. But there are some positions where, like, you know, big guys are necessary in modern football. And I mean, of course, I'm a Juventus fan, and, you know, Juventus built his fortune in the last years on, you know, Buffon, Barzagli, Bonucci, and Chiellini. Those four guys are 190. If they would have been 180, Juventus would have won half of the titles that they won in these years. Because, you know, like their size is one of the things that mattered when they were supposed to perform and to bring out results. So I think that really, you know, the JFA, but even, you know, at a high school level, you know, like, you know, we need to find a way to steal those tall guys, teach them how to play football, and somehow integrate them and just like our, you know, national teams and clubs. You know, how tall is Makina? I think he's 182, right?
That's about right.
It's like a tall guy. Yeah. He's a tall guy for Japan, but in Europe, as a center back, he's a dwarf. Mm. That's a matter of fact. You know, like Puyol and Cannavaro were the last two small, you know, center backs. After that, you know, like if you're not at least 186, 187, you can't stop Lewandowski or Lukaku. I mean, you can if they don't get any crosses, if you're lucky, you know, you go keep them as good saves. But, you know, overall, you're a huge disadvantage. That's really something we need to work on. Another thing to keep in mind is just like all those European, South American, you know, and just to extent African teams as well, they have a huge racial mix. So, you know, they can get a lot of different typologies of, you know, speed, you know, body size, you know, creativity, whatever. Japan is still an incredible, you know, homogeneous society. You know, 99%, I think, of the people in Japan are, you know, Japanese or, in, you know, from very close countries. So we don't have that advantage. There was like a, you know, like a pro-immigration to England publicity I've seen today. And it says this will be the English national team without immigrants. And, you know, there's only half of the team. Mm-hmm. Because half of the team, everybody from, you know, the belt up, all the offensive players in England now, all the starters, are immigrants, at least according to this. I mean, like, depends who you want to play. But, you know, let's say half of the teams are, you know, immigrants, my son of immigrants, grandchildren of immigrants. Hey, it's the same is true, of course, for Switzerland, for Germany, for France, okay? If you make a Japan without immigrants, it's exactly the same as the, you know, as the Japan that we have now, because there are no immigrants or children of immigrants. We got Lopez, we got Havner, Mike, we got Littanenari eventually, but those are really, you know, rarities. So since we don't have that advantage, you know, and the typology of player that we have all Japanese, I really think we need to grab more of those big guys. I know it sounds like a very, you know, simplistic aspect, but I think it's so simple that, you know, I don't understand why people don't see it. I mean, you know, you see it every week in the league. If you have a player like Patrick or Jay Boothroyd, they will score on any good cross. Every time they got a good cross, they basically, you know, head the ball and score. Why? because they're 10 centimeters bigger than the others, they got bigger bodies than the others. And, you know, that's what it takes sometimes to head the ball towards the goal or into the goal. That's one thing I think where I would really like to see some changes. And that's, you know, I've been talking about it for 10 years. And well, I don't expect, of course, you know, like just because I say it, everything to change. But it would be good if somebody, let's say somebody else, you know, without listening to me, will sort of like consider this an aspect that needs to be, you know, worked upon.
Indeed, indeed. Well, yeah, Japan, Japanese football's made a lot of strides in the last 20 years or so since the J-League was formed. But yes, obviously still a long way to go for Japan to be considered one of the big boys at the table of world football. And yeah, where performances where you make it out of your group and hopefully get through to the quarterfinals and further in World Cups, it becomes a realistic possibility. It was so close, of course, for Japan against Belgium, but it wasn't to be. And yeah, goodness knows what that win, if it had have come, would have meant for the Samurai Blue going forward. But yeah, we won't go through the game in minute detail, but obviously Japan made a dream start to the second half with the superb goals from Haraguchi and Inui, and we dared to dream. And while Eden Hazard hit the post for Belgium just seconds after Japan had taken the 1-0 lead, after that, their chances for them were pretty few and far between. I know Romelu Lukaku headed across the face of goal from close range just past the hour, but I don't know, Cesare, but before their first goal went in, I was struggling to see. Obviously, had a fear that Belgium could strike at any time, but when the goal came and in the manner that it came, it was such a frustrating goal to concede because, in the first place, I'm not even sure that Jan Vertonghen meant to head the ball on target.
Probably not.
It looked like he was just probably trying to head it back into the mixer, but yes, as it was, his header arced over Kawashima and found the net, and from there, yes, you wondered if Japan were going to be on the rack in a similar way that Belgium were earlier on in the second half, and so it was to be. And yes, it was that man Marouane Fellaini who equalised in the 74th minute. I think I heard on the Totally Football Show today, Cesare, there was 4 minutes and 16 seconds in between Japan's two goals and 4 minutes and 32 seconds, I think it was, between the Belgian goal. So, yes, stunning turns in momentum in the game. Japan is snatching momentum when it was up for grabs, basically, at the start of the second half. But then Belgium resting it back with 15 minutes to go. And, well, to Japan's credit, and I think, Scott, both of you might have mentioned it, Japan did not sit back at 2-2. They're obviously shell-shocked for a couple of minutes, but there were still chances at either end before, yes, that fateful ending.
Yeah, indeed, that was the case. And, you know, I think that, you know, Japan, you know, it was good to play, you know, the game openly until the very end. I really wish if I could turn time back, you know, like if I could just like, you know, enter the pitch and told the player on the last corner kick, just like, you know, guys, you know, like you don't need to score on this corner kick, you know, like you just like, you know, if it ends 2-2, we enjoy 30 more minutes and you're surely going to have your chances. I think, you know, Japan committed too much on that corner kick. And, when I saw how many players were up front, because I'm Italian, I'm, you know, like, of course, I say football first of all, defensively. That's maybe why I like the 2010 team better than 2018 teams, by the way. But, you know, I said, oh, there's too many of them. If there's a quick counterattack, it's going to be, you know, yeah, it's going to be pretty bad. And by the time I finished my thought, the counterattack had started already.
Right.
And, you know, of course, Japan had scored one goal from a corner kick against Colombia. That probably gave him confidence. But statistically, I think I read that, you know, you have goal and corner kicks on one chance every 45 corners. So in the top major leagues in Europe. So, wow. You know, the chance of scoring, not, you know, very high. It's like around 2%. So committing so much. I'm also wondering if just like, you know, maybe the criticism for the last minutes against Poland were something that, you know, had Japan to just like to play those last minutes, you know, with more bravery. One thing that, you know, it wasn't much in the comments. You know, there was a free kick for Japan with a few minutes left, and Honda took it brilliantly, I think. And that was a super save by Courtois. I really think that, you know, had Courtois been a bit less focused, that could have been like an amazing winner for Japan. You know, the free kick seemed okay when, you know, like when he took it, but when they showed it from behind, from Honda's perspective, you could really see the ball going down fast. It was somehow very similar to the goal he scored against Denmark in 2010.
Absolutely, yeah.
Just imagine had there been, you know, like, let's say, you know, we play some trickery and we switch the goalkeepers. It could have been a different story. I'm really sorry for all this, you know, Kawashima bashing, you know, like, and, you know, of course we respect the guy. He's a very smart guy as well. You know, everybody knows he speaks like six languages or something. And he had an overall very good career. I mean, making it, you know, playing so many years abroad, as a Japanese goalkeeper is by itself an achievement. But, you know, I mean, as I said, you know, in this tournament, he was a weak link of the whole team. And, you know, it could have really been a different story, you know, if Japan had a better goalkeeper.
Yes, indeed. And, yeah, that is something that will nag at, yeah, as I said earlier with Scott, it will something that will nag at, yeah, all of us, I think, for a while to come, because yeah, what might have been is something that we'll have to get our heads around eventually. But this, yeah, obviously this promised to be at 2-0 with the, you know, with 20 odd minutes to go. This promised to be the biggest occasion in Japanese footballing history, and as it turned out, it's come and it's been one of the most crushing disappointments. But overall, for me personally, I mean, yes, there are some who are saying that, you know, we shouldn't be, you know, taking pride in this performance, because ultimately it's ended in defeat. But for me, just sort of, you know, exceeded expectations, then in the bigger picture, this tournament has to be considered a success. I don't know how you feel about it, Cesare. It's probably still a bit too raw, but...
Well, you know, football is interesting. You can always see things from, you know, like one little event in a game changes everything, as we said before. So one way you can say this is just, you know, Japan in the end, you know, lost two games, tied one, and won one against a 10, you know, player squad. Yeah. Team, you know, like, and so, well, is that good? No, it's not really impressive. But I think that, really, because anyway, you know, despite what Scott said, I'm sorry, I disagree, winning a tournament was never an option. You know, it, you know, this, in my opinion, there's no way Japan could have beaten Brazil, especially after the effort that they produced in this game. But, you know, the positives is that, like, unlike in 2015, Japan was never humiliated, never, you know, nobody could make a fool of Japan. And, you know, the players did well. Japan played at the same level of some top national teams. So it's, you know, of course it has to be a very positive, you know. Nobody laughed of Japan throughout this tournament, except, of course, for the goalkeeper. But we've been over that already enough, I think.
Indeed, indeed. All right. Well, yes. As I said, yeah, we didn't go through the game in minute detail as we have for the three group stage games, I think, because yeah, we're still a bit groggy from both getting up at 3 a.m. and it's just about to tick over to midnight Tuesday night Japan time. And also, yeah, things are a little bit raw, and we don't necessarily want to put ourselves through going through this game in such minute detail, because it's yeah, it's still something that we need to process over the coming day. So I guess for now, Cesare, we can probably leave it there. Thank you so much again for your thoughts on the Samurai Blue, their campaign in Russia. Well, let me just leave you with a question, and it's a question without notice. Who will be managing Japan at the 2019 Asian Cup?
It has to be Nishino. I think he deserved it. I think it has to be Nishino, and I think that, you know, yeah, he has all it takes. You know, like, he proved himself as a good, you know, in understanding his players. I hope to see, okay, the thing, I really hope to see you know, some changes, you know, like I hope to see, you know, let's tell you, I would like to see Maya and Nagatomo in the team again. I think we need them. And I would, of course, Shibazaki, Inui, those guys, you know, they need to be there. But, you know, I also like to see some new faces. I'd like to see the guys who have been excluded in, you know, like for this tournament to get a chance. Those guys who, you know, like, you know, when maybe, you know, Belgium and Portugal are not, you know, top leagues, but those are, you know, I'm talking about, of course, you know, Doan, Nagashima, Morioka, and Kubo. Those are guys who, you know, like, really, really, you know, worked, you know, very hard to get where they are. They had great seasons. I hope they, you know, they keep it up throughout the first half of the next season, and they will be in at the Asia Cup. Yeah, one last thing. I will just ask you one thing, since we're talking about the national team and the future, and you're an FC Tokyo fan. What do you think of the other Kubo? when do you think he will be ready? And do you think that bringing him to the Asia Cup will be just like, you know, something, you know, too much, too early? Because, you know, like we've seen at this World Cup some 19, 20-year-old player doing extremely well. I mean, of course, everybody has seen Mbappe, but also Bentancur from Uruguay, I think, has been really amazing. He's 20. And so I'm wondering if just like considering it's, you know, the World Cup is, you know, only the Asia Cup, and Japan really needs to start building toward, because, you know, Takefusa Kubo needs to be in the next World Cup, right? Mm. It'd be a major failure if he's not in World Cup. So which tournament do you have to get him going, you know, at a certain level besides this one?
Yeah, it's a really difficult one. And, yeah, I mean, obviously, if a player's good enough, he's old enough. It's just the simple fact that Kubo hasn't had enough opportunities in the FC Tokyo first team yet. And while he has done well for Japan, obviously, at international youth levels, in terms of, regular club football, he's mainly been restricted to playing for the FC Tokyo under-23s in J3, where... you know, I don't obviously watch all of those games, but I wouldn't suggest that there's been rave reviews over his performances. That's, of course, to be expected as a, you know, a 17-year-old. But, yeah, it's definitely something that if it's Nishino, he might have to consider. But knowing Nishino's selection policy for this World Cup, obviously he'll obviously expand his horizons, you'd imagine, with the Asian Cup in mind, if indeed he is the coach. But... I wonder whether he would be given a chance. It's a really tricky one. I hope he gets more opportunities in the FC Tokyo first team, but of course the manager of FC Tokyo, Kenta Hasegawa, wants to do the best for FC Tokyo, not necessarily the best for Takefusa Kubo's international future. So, it'll just be interesting to see how many opportunities he gets in the second half of the J1 season. He did feature a couple of times in the Levain Cup, but it's an interesting question, and it's one that Nishino will have to consider. But of course, there are probably 6 or 7 players who we were all as disappointed didn't make the World Cup squad that are ahead of Kubo in the queue. So if not when Kubo gets a chance with the national team with the Asian Cup in mind. But yeah, good question to finish on, Cesare.
All right. Thanks for the answer.
No worries. Not at all. Thank you very much, as I said, for your time and your thoughts on this episode. It's been fantastic. Obviously, wish it was in better circumstances, but I hope to speak to you down the road with J1 getting back underway in the middle of July, and enjoy the rest of the World Cup.
And you too. Thanks very much. It's always a pleasure and a privilege. Thanks to everybody for listening, and, you know, keep it up. You're doing a great job with this podcast. You know, I enjoy them on, you know, a regular basis, and, you know, it's great to be your guest.
All right. Well, that's very nice of you to say, Cesare, and a lovely way to finish. Thank you very much. All right. Well, that is it for this episode of the J-Talk podcast, and indeed for the Samurai Blue at the World Cup. My thanks again to Cesare Polenghi, Scott McIntyre, and to you for listening wherever you are. Not quite sure when our next episode of the podcast will be. As I mentioned, J1 resumes in the middle of July, but then I'm heading back to Australia for about 10 days with my family, so won't be able to catch, I think, 2 or 3 rounds of J1 matches. So we might have to wait until the end of July, or maybe the beginning of August, for our next episode. But stay tuned to @JTalkPod on Twitter for information on that. Speak to you again soon then. Bye for now. Oh, and P.S., no children were actually harmed in the recording of our outro.
So Kagawa against Ospina, and Japan take the lead. Ospina stays at home, and it's in. Japan hit the front again. Yuya Osako, look at his leap there.
Nagatomo's done well here. He's got support from Inui. He looks for the opening, and he finds it. Super strike. Lovely goal to Takashi Inui. Osako sends it floating in. Keeper Kane didn't get there. There's a chance. Honda scores.
Put into the box. Headed on in the direction of Kawashimi. Kept it out. Diving right-handed save.
It's missed by Vertonghen. It's a great chance for Haraguchi. He scores. Here's Kagawa. Trying to find room for the shot. He'll eventually come in. 2-0. Takashi Inui, what a strike!